You're listening to SBS News.
An infectious diseases researcher says between 200 and 400 million people around the world have experienced long COVID. It's a chronic condition that occurs after someone gets infected with COVID and is present for at least 3 months. The chief executive of the Burnet Institute in Melbourne, Professor Brendan Crabb, told SBS's Greg Diet, the ongoing increase in long COVID case numbers is alarming.
The real number is likely to be something between 200 and 400 million people in the world, so 2.5% to 5% of the entire world's population. Not everyone counts, of course, their cases of long COVID, but the US does reasonably well, and the UK does, different methodologies, and generally they're getting something in the range of 4, 5, 6 or even 7% of the entire population, US population, who have some form of long COVID. Around 25% plus of those severely debilitated so that they can't continue in their normal work or school life. So that's, you know, pretty much adults and kids, perhaps a lesser number for kids, but still there. So the numbers are huge. Now, I should also say, well, we're still on numbers that they are increasing. The US figures and the UK figures over the last year have increased by about a percentage point. And so what that's telling you is that not only is long COVID continuing from 2020-2021 in a reasonable proportion of people, not all poor people, perhaps more than half of them have recovered or recovered to a degree, but some haven't. So they're lingering out still in year, you know, 2, 3, 4. And then there are many new cases. So the viruses that we're all getting infected with now are causing long COVID still in 5 to 10+% of people, depending on the category. So the numbers are growing, and given COVID, acute COVID is still just so prevalent in the community the whole year round, there is this growing burden, and Australia has a similar burden. It's probably about half of those figures. We don't have exact figures here because we didn't have any cases effectively in the first 2 years, so a very small number of COVID cases. We didn't have any long COVID cases. So we've started post-vaccine, but clearly we've got a very substantial and growing problem as well. So it's just mind-bogglingly big, translating to, you know, how people would work and get educated and so on. In terms of what long COVID is, it's been an amazing year for that, especially this year, just the last 6 months. All the major scientific journals, Nature, Science, New England Journal, Cell, for putting on my scientific nerd hat, have published landmark papers on long COVID. This is mainstream science. It's in the big time. And what a lot of that work is revealing in a nutshell are the biological underpinnings of this disease. Right? It's often thought of as long COVID sort of in people's head. Is it? It's a mystery. Actually, much less so. There's a lot of... It's a complicated illness, but... Yeah, there's very clear biological underpinnings, and the most significant of those is the growing evidence that long COVID, at least in many cases, if not possibly all cases, is actually long infection. So when we think of a respiratory infection like COVID as you being positive for 5, 10, maybe a few more days, and then you're negative, you know, your RAT test goes negative, the virus has gone away. Well, it turns out that in many people, the virus doesn't go away. Now, it doesn't mean you're strongly positive by your RAT test, but the virus disseminates throughout your body. It's not a strictly respiratory infection. It's a blood vessel infection, and it finds its way to different organs in the body. And what it's looking like is in some places it can reside at lower levels in a living form, in a replicating form, for a long period of time. And this is starting to look like a real smoking gun for a causal underpinning of COVID, long COVID. Long COVID, we know the pathologies. It looks like an immune response that doesn't stop. So an inflammatory response where your immune cells go to tissues and they attack those tissues trying to get the virus. When we suffer an illness, the headache we have or the clinical effect we have is often a mixture of the pathogen itself and the immune response attacking that pathogen. So when you've got a chronic infection, you get this immune system just attacking all the time. You get disease all the time. And because it's disseminated, it explains why, you know, the syndromes for long COVID are quite wide. But, you know, to the things that people will be familiar with are the symptoms. You get fatigue, chronic fatigue. Literally, there's a lot of overlap between chronic fatigue syndrome and the chronic fatigue that people with long COVID suffer. But a range of other effects that people suffer from, this so-called dysautonomia, where the automatic part of your nervous system that you don't have to think about that modulates your heart rate or your breathing rate or digestive system and so on is dysregulated, and that has various really quite debilitating effects on you.
So now the science is in, what should Australia be doing that it's not doing already? Because we have long COVID clinics, and you'll see people posting online saying, oh, I've had to wait however many months, you know, and I'm burdened by it. Do we need to be investing more in that space?
I think that that we are improving our response to long COVID. We had a pretty fabulous long COVID inquiry in our federal parliament, the so-called Sick and Tired Casting a Long Shadow report. It's a tremendous report and with very strong recommendations. So there's a positive indicator there that was before a lot of the advances that I've mentioned that have dealt with you know, the reality of COVID and offered solutions as to how we might deal with it. For example, if long COVID really is driven by long infection, if that turns out, then trialling antiviral approaches as solutions to long COVID is a good way to go. Look, I think it's a bit like the clean air issue. The biggest challenge is one of messaging still. Long COVID has not hit the big time, from my point of view, from a policymaker perspective yet in messaging. And, of course, it's dogged by lots of misunderstanding, by lots of patients feel what they call gaslighted, including by people in the medical profession. Many medical professionals don't understand it, and certainly not to the degree that I've just explained it. That this, you know, it's as biological as breaking your leg, right? But they don't know that, and so we need to get our messaging straight to say we've got a new disease here, a new illness here that is growing. We don't have all the answers to it, but you do need to know it's there. And the second thing we need to do is that should drive a change to trying to prevent COVID. We don't have cures for long COVID yet. I should say there are, once you're going to medical professionals who know about long COVID, there are things you can do for symptom alleviation. For the dysautonomia, for example, it can be treated. So it's not like nothing can be done. But there are no cures yet. And so the most important way to prevent long COVID is to not get COVID. Now, this is fundamental because our strategy at the moment in Australia is that it's okay to get COVID for most people. Not for everyone, not if you're so-called vulnerable. You know, you've got an autoimmune disease or you're elderly. No one wants you to get COVID, and that's government policy to try and protect those people. But for the rest of us, it's sort of okay, this notion that we have, it builds hybrid immunity. We're all vaccinated, so you can get infected, no harm for that. That's not true. You can't pick who's vulnerable to long COVID. We're getting repeatedly infected, and every time you get infected, we now know that the chances of long COVID were the same as the previous time. So your lifetime risk, if you have five COVID infections, for example, in the course of 5 years, is five times what it was if you had one infection. Now, if it's 10% each time sort of thing, you can see how the risk accumulates. So we need to change our strategy to care more about the amount of transmission in the community. The good news is that, you know, especially through clean air strategies, upping our vaccination a bit and people being encouraged to get tested, we can do a lot about it. You know, I've talked about virus running rampant, but actually the effective R, the number of people who are transmitting to other people, is only ever a little bit above one when the epidemic is growing and below one when it's declining. We need to do a bit more to bring it below one all the time.
Is it reasonable to conclude that at the moment, when it comes to COVID messaging generally, it's scant?
It's become almost a taboo topic, of course, to go take that one step further. So you can read an article on all the respiratory infections around Australia at the moment. The headline will have flu and RSV in it, but it won't have COVID in it, and then the COVID will be in the body of the text, even though it's causing literally 10 to 100 times the effect of those other issues. So there's a taboo element to it. I think there's a collective trauma. I'm not a psychologist, but there'll be reasons for that I'm not blaming others for. But somehow we have to get back into the real world. We have something here that is a big problem for us. It is the worst of the infectious diseases problems. All of a sudden, for the first time in a very long time, Australia has an infectious disease in its top few causes of death. We've just been talking about chronic illness. It's a massive chronic illness burden. We have to not panic about it. I'm definitely not saying that. I'm not saying we need to go back to the highest level of alert for it. But we have to recalibrate really quite seriously to be open about dealing with COVID, COVID prevention on the one hand, and COVID solutions. We need a cure for long COVID. And I think where the science is going, we can get there. Australia has to join that train.
My guest on SBS News is infectious diseases researcher and the chief executive of the Burnet Institute in Melbourne, Professor Brendan Crabb. So how should we be thinking about dealing with it? Because people know on an individual level, you know, get vaccinated, wear a mask where you want to. One of the things you've been quite vocal about over the years is clean air. What should we be thinking about in that space?
Well, with respect to clean air, what we're meaning here is particularly clean indoor air, is that breathing clean air, breathing air that doesn't have virus in it, is one of only three things really you can do for respiratory diseases, like flu, like RSV, and of course like COVID. The others being you can get vaccinated for most of these, certainly for flu and COVID, and absolutely that's the first and most important thing you should do, and keep up with those vaccines. The other thing you can do is to get tested and act on that test. Isolate, get treated if you're eligible to get treated, protect those around you sort of thing. But the only other thing you can do is breathe clean air. That means you're in a room like we are at the moment, Greg, that I know has good air quality in it. And if you're not in a room that has good air quality in it, or that room is crowded, you can wear a mask, a properly fitted respirator-type mask, not just a surgical mask. That's kind of it, right? Mm. And so the first reason we're interested in clean indoor air is that it's one of those things you can do. The second reason is it's the only one that, like drinking clean water, doesn't require a social license. Once it's in place, people will just benefit from it. They won't have to think from it. So it's a powerful tool, also doesn't require that social license. Now, why we're in this position, though, is where we don't have clean indoor air, or we don't have standards for clean indoor air. No one knows whether you're walking into a space, whether it's well-controlled or not, is that this is the big neglected public health area. I've mentioned clean water already, well-regulated. Our food, well-regulated. Outdoor air, well-regulated. indoor air, where we spend 90% of our time completely neglected. There's a number of reasons for that, but in the infectious disease space, it's been stymied by a dogma that we call the droplet dogma, where infectious diseases transmitted by the respiratory tract were thought to be transmitted by large droplets that fall to the ground very quickly. So if you're in close proximity to someone, you could get infected. If you're not in close proximity, you can't. That's proven not to be the case. In my, from my perspective, as I've mentioned many times in the last few years, it's the biggest missed opportunity of the pandemic, nationally and internationally, that we didn't treat the transmission of COVID as kind of a crucial issue to interrupt. So we washed our hands and we sanitised benchtops and so on, and when there were outbreaks. Neither of us probably did much. Washing hands is a very good public health intervention. I encourage everyone listening to this to wash their hands. It's not going to stop many COVID transmissions. It's going to help in other respects. So clean indoor air is the big opportunity now, and we're starting to see some momentum in that space. There's some low-hanging fruit and there's some much harder pathways ahead. But it's the main game from my perspective in managing the pandemic of today, other respiratory infections of today, and preparing for the next big pandemic. We're watching flu very closely in cattle in the US at the moment. Of course, pandemic influenza has been the biggest concern for the last 100 years. And when that hits, if we have clean indoor air standards, we're half ready already.